welcome to We're All Gonna Die, Another Fun Facts. A semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. You would think after 50-some episodes I wouldn't have to read that sentence, but here we are. Our episode today is entitled, Love Poems. Nothing but love poems. And it's about a great new collection on from Logos Press entitled, Unconditional Surrender, an anthology of love poems. And our many guests for this episode are some folks who know something about, well, I guess we've established not love. That was the pre-conversation that you're not going to find out about podcast people. But people who maybe know something about love poems, or have at least written love poems, or have at least produced a collection of love poems, at least. And I guess we can go around the horn and go introduce yourselves so I don't bungle last names like I tend to do, because I can't pronounce words at all, ever. So here we go.
Here we go. I'm Scott Silsby. I'm an assistant editor at Logos Press.
I'm Christopher Collins. I'm publisher and editor at Logos Press.
I'm Stephanie Bria, and I have two poems featured in this collection.
Hi, I'm Richard Jijic, and I have three poems in this collection.
Fantastic. And I thought maybe the best thing, actually, Richard, if you could start us out, if you could throw us into this collection so that we can get maybe a sense of the mood of...
Make a swoon, Rich.
Make a swoon.
I'm pretty good at that. All right. This one's called Frank Sinatra Playing on the Jukebox, 2016. My cigarette cherry is a radio tower's blinking red light. Emergency broadcast. Please don't touch the dial. Seek shelter immediately in a sturdy building or tuck yourself underneath a highway overpass. There are always men in these holes. Men like me, who are just the splintered stumps of trees after a tornado has come through. Trying to douse the videotapes of regret and shame playing on loop in their minds with high-proof liquor and set them aflame. It's the sound that kills me here. The sound of another night falling into another morning, like the sound of my former lover's sheer panties sliding down the warm skin of her thighs to reveal her beauty to another man who in this barstool nightmare has no face but everything I do not have. A steady checking account with a comma in the balance. A new car able to withstand the rigors of a cross-country road trip she always wanted to take. A passport for spontaneous weekends, drinking cocktails along the Saint-Laurent in Montreal. White teeth, the cocaine that gets her off. Could be 1954, 1971, or any time, for there are always men like me sweating through 9 innings in the summer, ice melting in our glasses of whiskey, longing with shaking hands permanently stained black from reaching through coal soot and slag heaps for someone who is no longer anyone or anything more than the sliver of a fingernail, chewed off and carelessly spit to my bedroom floor that now rests on my nightstand, hard and brittle, a slice of DNA, a token I am unwilling and unable to throw away. These wee hours, the songs blow out of that jukebox and cry the tears that all these months later I cannot. Though I have learned my lesson that time heals nothing. No matter how hard I try to feel like love's not around, it's always so uncomfortably near.
Wow. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. It's just great. And I think in a lot of ways, it encapsulates, I think, what is interesting about this collection, you know, and the way in which love, I don't want to use the academic term, problematizes, or at least kind of gets the obvious sentiments of love out of the way, and how even, you know, a poem like this that it's about, yeah, heartbreak and regret, it is that there is this sort of multifaceted kind of dimensions of different emotions about love, which I think is what makes this collection so interesting. And I maybe want to kind of turn to the editors here and like, what the hell were you thinking? You know, you and Nathan
Kukulski.
Nathan Kukulski.
See, I can't pronounce things. Yeah,
that's cool.
You know, in the sort of genesis of this collection and sort of looking at, you know, because I know we talked about this, Christopher, last time you were on the podcast. I guess Logos does things a little differently. Right, in terms of...
You could say that.
Certainly financially, we need to do
Yes, by the way, there's only, what, 200 of these things in existence?
That's it.
It's I have number 200, seven.
There's usually 100 of Logos first editions, but this one we did 200 because there are just so many poets.
You got so a top 10. That's I got a collectible.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's collectible. Yeah, not a rookie card, yeah.
You got to get everybody to sign it. So work on that.
Work on that.
You get a tenth of it with the people in the room now,
I think.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Knock that out real quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can probably sign someone else's name, too, if you want.
Yeah.
So the genesis. Chris, you came up with the idea.
I like putting anthologies together. It's an interesting challenge to try to combine that many voices. And there are 20 poets in this collection. So I like the challenge of it, for one thing. I like to see what people come up with when you present a theme to them, a fairly abstract thing, and what comes back, whether it works together or not. You just don't know. An anthology of love poems I've wanted to do for a while now. A couple of years, at least, it's been in my kind of back pocket. As the first anthology that we would do for Logos. Is it possible first? I mean, Scott here had to clear it. He could have shot it down. I'm like, no, that fucking sucks. Don't do that. I don't want to be a part of it. You're on your own, Collins. I thought I enjoy writing love poems. I feel like if I'm doing it right, then whatever I'm writing is a love poem in its way. Mm. So I feel that there's a lot of space in a love poem to what could actually go in there and what it's about. It's not just simply a, you know, Hallmark card. It can get a much more complicated, as you were saying earlier, a much more complicated vision of the emotions that we feel towards one another. I kind of wanted to do that. It changed a bit in my mind after the election. It took on, as everything did, it became a political statement in its way, which, you know, when I first presented it and I was first thinking about it, it wasn't that at all. It didn't have that dynamic to it, but I think it does now. I think that... writing about, and we try to broach that in the introduction that's in the book, why we did it and why we thought it was an important thing to do, that at this point, any kind of connecting tissue we can bring to the fore between people, and different people, there are 20 different people in here, very different people, different approaches to poetry, different life experiences, different ways of going about your business, but when it came together, I thought it felt pretty organic. And reading the book through, I was just rereading it today, and I had not read it for a couple of weeks. It felt like the voices blended together, even though I know how different all of these people are, how disparate those voices actually are if you sat down with them individually. So I thought, you know, in that sense, it was kind of necessary, certainly for me, not feeling too great about humanity and in a lot. I mean, I never do to begin with, but I've had, like, you know, it's a kick in the ass to see just the worst aspects of humanity just let loose in your country. So to see thoughtfulness, you know, respect, you know, consideration of emotions and other people. For me, I needed to see it. So it became a personal thing for me much more than it was just a project
It was required. Required reading for me, if for no other reason. Yeah,
I had the advantage of the day after I picked it up that it was paper turn-in day in my classes, so I got to actually burn through the collection 3 times in one day. You know, I kind of sat through and got through the one, and then, you know, then my the 1 o'clock class, and then my 3 o'clock class, and then I got to kind of, like, really soak in. And I mean, thinking about, like, poems like, you know, Frank Sinatra playing on the jukebox 2016, I think there's also something that's just also, to tap into this sort of political nature, I think there's something just inherently political in being able to be comfortable dealing with all facets of the human experience. Or, I mean, you know, Richard, I guess this question is about you, about the poem, you know, tapping into these sort of negative feelings and being willing to share them, as opposed to, I don't know, I mean, our country is, if it's being ruined, is being ruined by people who are probably not comfortable in their own skin.
Well, not, I mean, yeah. You got it. These guys approached me about submitting some poems to them, and I, you know, really didn't have any love poems in my pocket because they're, to me, hard to write. They're an exercise in a different kind of vulnerability, I think, than, you know, writing anything else. They require a different kind of care to get the emotions right, I feel, or at least something that I'm not necessarily completely comfortable with in writing. It's a different, you have to tackle a few different things.
Yeah, and I think the poem certainly does that in a really interesting way, you know. Whereas, yeah, I mean, you know, I also go back to, you know, the Allen Ginsberg thing, right? You know, who are these jerks who know nothing about life? And who are they to push us around, right? And that's where we are. And so I think that's what makes, yeah, this collection sort of timely. And I think about, too, I mean, I think about Stephanie, about your poem, for the girl who dated my upstairs neighbor, not to put you, it's on page 82. See, I bookmarked.
I just got here.
Oh, good. See, I use poem. That's, you know, and thinking about how also love and these aspects of, I don't know, power or aspects of the way in which, you know, there's all just inherent vulnerability. And, you know, we I think are all maybe a little vulnerable, or at least all susceptible to assholes and monsters, which I think is sort of in the background of a lot of these poems. I mean, again, they're not to sound, you know, and the poem collection is called, of course, Unconditional Surrender, you know, but
we should only say it like that from now on.
That's the way to say it.
But there are, I mean, they're truly, I mean, really touching, beautiful. I mean, you know, the second Laura Jaquila poem, I almost lost my shit, actually, the first time I read it. And just sitting there in front of the classroom as students are filling out their reflection pieces on their paper, I make them start to edit their stuff, their work, immediately. When it's done and perfect, it's like, no, now you got to write on it and start working on it again. And they hate me for it. And then, you know, you can't cry in that situation, but kind of wanted to. But, you know, but I held it in. I'm a man. I don't have feelings. And
that
so
Jaquila poem always does it to me, too. And I've heard her read it a few times, and it's just, it's always devastating.
But Stephanie, so, I mean, I think yours, too, I mean, has this lovely bit of critique in it. It's a love poem, but it has, it's a pointed love poem, isn't it? Well, or sort of, or pointed.
So the one that you're referencing was actually a found poem. So it's based on a true story. And, which I think is important maybe for readers to know. I guess you don't know that unless you hear me tell you that. But it's definitely a critique. It's, I typically write from the female experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that when people read this poem, they will understand where I'm coming from and why. So, yeah. Do you want me to read it right now?
Yes, please.
Look at that. All right.
Yes, please.
Okay, this is a poem for the girl who dated my upstairs neighbor. Today I found a note, crumpled, discarded, near my front door. A crazy beg for forgiveness, note of apology, 2-page explanation. I thought that if I were skinnier, I would be better at everything, she wrote. Tiny cramped letters, she wanted them skinny too. I remember her hip bones, wrist bones, ass crack, lowrider jeans, midriff skimming shirts, her downcast eyes when I passed her on the lawn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's for every girl who thought she wasn't good enough, and for every girl who suffers with body image, which is a lot of us. Yeah. So.
And for every girl, I think, too, who those downcast eyes, mm-hmm. you know, to be made to be made to think you're worthless or that your place in the world is to be turned down, silenced, moved mm-hmm. to the side, you know, which is, well, our new political order, yes, but, you know, I guess it's, you know, I, for me, again, I mean, not to harp on this, but I'm going to harp on this, about this collection, how there are no, I don't think there are any obvious love poems, you know what I mean? In terms of, like, what we would sort of classically think as mm-hmm. as love poems, and I guess, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's another question about the editorial process, but was there stuff that you were just like, you know, that was just too on the nose, or, you know, because it's one of the things that I always, you know, try to, you know, impress upon my students is making them think in surplus so that they have to dig a little deeper. You know, we want the easy, fast, right answer because, you know, I'm sure we've all had that moment where we sat at the microwave and gone, 2 minutes for soup if we lost a war. You know what I mean, right? But in this case, you know, in a love poem should be about, I don't know, flowers or something. But, you know, I mean, it was that a conscious sort of decision or when you were picking and choosing, was there things, you know, without mentioning names except for home addresses and phone numbers maybe of rejected writers. Just kidding. Things you're like, no, that's too, I mean, was this a self-conscious effort or is just did the poets themselves just produce?
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, it wasn't like an open call, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's, again, as you mentioned earlier, we continued the way we normally work a logos collection book. With this one, and that we didn't open a call mm-hmm. to just send in love poems.
So don't do that, people.
No, no, stop writing me about your manuscripts, please. I'm sure they're wonderful, and I'll read them, but I don't want them. No, we knew people that we wanted to work with, and some of the people in the collection are writers that we worked with and published before mm-hmm. that are in there. Allie, Jay,
Bob.
And others were people that we really wanted to work with. We just really admire their writing. And, you know, the way small press publishing works when, you know, you're kind of all out of pocket and, it takes about a year or so for a Logos book to come out from when we start working with a writer to the end. We know that there are a lot of writers we're just not going to get to work with that we would love to, for whatever reason, time, what we want, what they want to do with their work, for any given reason. I mean, you have two writers in this room right now we love, we admire their work incredibly and wanted them in a Logos book. Whether this is the only time either of them appear in Logos or not, we wanted to make sure we had you guys on the roster in some fashion. So yeah, we look to people that we really, you know, who we're going to bring interesting things to a fairly basic idea around poetry. I mean, mm-hmm. I think most readers who don't read poetry, if you ask them, what are poems about? Mm-hmm. They would probably say love. I mean, that's like, I think a number one response if we were doing a family feud. exactly. Yeah. I think, oh, it's just about love. So I was definitely interested in this group of poets and what they right. would bring to this.
So topic. The people that we like made a list of, like the people that we wanted for the anthology, we knew they weren't going to be writing Hallmark versions of love poems. But then, so we, you know, called, like, made a call to the people that we wanted in the anthology. And then the poems we got back, I think that we did intentionally want a pretty diverse assortment of types of love represented, you know, and types of, you know, the ideas of love in the poems, right?
Yeah, we wanted that, and part of the introduction to the book is actually the pitch that we gave the writers. That first paragraph was in that pitch, and we used that, particularly the really sort of hoity-toity Barthes quote,
yeah, Rolly, you know? Rolly Bart,
yeah, to kind of, as you say, kind of complicate the issue of love and what we were looking for, to make sure everybody knew anything was fair game going into it. We weren't looking for anything in particular. We just wanted to see what you would come back with. And what you see on the page is what the writers brought back. I mean, if we invited you in, for the most part, we took what writers gave us. We asked for up to 3 poems per writer. And maybe 1 or 2, you know, just didn't fit. It just didn't work in the collection. Mm-hmm. So we edited those out. We're like, well, we like these 2, but not this one. This one doesn't seem to fit. And looking at everything together, once you had everything together, it was clear what wasn't going to work in the collection. You know, what was going to be out of bounds. And at that point, it was just a matter of sequencing it. To try and give some kind of extra texture to the material.
Have some kind of flow.
Yeah, you want a flow. You want that.
So now we have this unique opportunity then, because now Richard and Stephanie, I mean, how did you respond to the Barthes quote, right? I mean, I have the book that's actually, that might be right behind Scott.
Lover's Discourse
might be in there. I don't remember anymore.
Yeah.
But how did you respond to, in your kind of creative process, being, you know, getting this invitation, getting this pitch, what was your response or thought process in terms of, I guess, composing, submitting? How did that work for the two of you?
Because
now you get to find out. I mean, this could have just been a happy accident. You guys could have just been dopes and just kind of thing.
If they don't answer right, people, we're just going to rip them
right out. So I only have two and not three. We can talk about that.
Well, we can, you know, there's only 200 of these, so it wouldn't be too bad. I mean,
no, we can do that.
That's like a month of breaking into people's houses.
I can buy a gross of black Sharpies and just... wreck this. I'll just redact the hell out of it.
I'll buy all of them at the City of Asylum tomorrow.
We do have to visit several bookstores.
Yeah.
Shoplift those, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't shoplift from independent bookstores. But
anyway. All right, so I guess I'll go first.
Thank you.
Save us.
Thank you.
So pulling it back. We're pulling it back. Okay. So I feel that the call and the pitch made it easy for me. To kind of figure out what I wanted to send to both of you. I was honored to be asked, first of all. I do feel that unconventional love is something that I write about a lot in my work in some ways. Maybe you guys can agree. That's probably maybe one of the reasons why you asked me. So it wasn't hard. Both of these poems had been read out a lot. Unlike Rich, I didn't write to the pitch. I already had these. And so I pulled together ones that I thought were sort of tied to this sort of unconventional idea. Various speakers were represented, sort of various themes. And so I found that for me personally, it was easy. Send. So, but... Yeah, Rich.
Well, I got the pitch, and I was like, "Oh shit!" I mean, I did a little sweating. I was like, "Well, I'd like to be in that." And the genesis of the poems just—I mean, really—last summer when the pitch came through, I was that poem, the Frank Sinatra poem I read, I just watched a long documentary on Sinatra, and that song, Angel Eyes, really struck me. I was like, maybe I could do something with that. You know, how am I going to work that? And then the other ones came fairly quickly, even though still, I think, until like the moment I hit send, I was like, Jesus, do I want to turn these in or what, you know? Because, like, you know, you it's writing about love is to me a very vulnerable thing. So I was like, all right, we'll see how this goes. And I got in, so I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, it's part of the, you know, request process. You get a ringer, and then you get somebody you can fuck with. Yeah. So those at home who want to make your own anthology.
Yeah, that's the process.
That's the process.
Can we get Rich to read another?
Yeah, actually, and could that other be Paul Lachelle? Actually, that's what I was going to say, because I think, you know, as a quote, so get confident, stupid. No, but I mean, your poems were so good.
Well,
holy
thank
shit.
You, friend. I
They're
appreciate
so
that.
Good. I mean, the part of me that tries to write poetry actually, like, sort of irrationally hates you. Oh. You know, just a little bit now. But I'll get over it. I'll get over it. My motion cycle. The show starts over about every 2 minutes.
Take a deep breath. Yeah.
Take a deep breath. But I mean, your poems are so poignant. Holy crap! You
I know? Appreciate that.
And so, for you, all of you creative friends out there in the world, you know, it's okay. If this poem, Polish Hell, you think this person wrote this poem, Polish Hell, and thought, I don't know if it's good enough, you're probably good enough too. And I'm pointing at the microphone because I'm pointing at you, listener, and this is, it's a microphone, so it's not going to pick up my point. So I'm bad at this. So
here we go, Richard. Thank you.
Yeah,
so
of
much.
Course.
Save us again.
All right.
Saved by the poets.
Polish Hill. All the balding punk rockers turned into a choir for us. Singing along to Black Sabbath, playing on the jukebox, pounding shots, and in the bar light we were angels carrying flaming swords at our sides up here on this hill, up here where champagne flutes shatter on the streets early morning, the sky still dark, the birds clamoring for the sun, up here where homeless cats loiter on the porches of strangers, searching for food, for an affectionate hand. Up here is the index finger of this city, tapping our chest to make its point. We traded those cursed men wearing their studs and leather, exchanged dim bar lamp for orange streetlight glow, a cold sixer in a brown bag, and the stairs across the street, obscured by knotweed, strangled by the healthy green of June. There on the concrete we were no longer angels, just the grown children of so many semesters ago. The kites of our own solitude fastened to our wrists and floating above our heads. There, with nobody singing, nobody to witness, we tied those strings together so tightly we had no choice but to cut them apart later on.
Wow.
Damn.
Damn,
that's in a Low Ghost book. Awesome.
When I sat there and I didn't know if I was good enough.
Hey.
Well, I mean, there is that. I will say, you know, there is that element of, like, you maybe just read something so much that you kind of get word blind to it.
Yeah,
you know?
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, mm-hmm. You don't know, but I mean, the ending is so good, and the ending is so, and where it sets up. I was gonna ask the question, but I don't want you to answer it, because the question is Rock Room or Goose Geese. I don't want to know.
I want to know. What if it's the third one?
Can you?
Oh, yeah, well, it could be a different
one. House Bar?
What's that?
House Bar. Oh, that's right. There is the one by the church.
Yeah, like across from the church.
Yeah.
So,
but balding punk rockers would probably be.
Yeah.
Is it the Leather Bar by the bridge?
Oh, that's long closed, my friend.
Leather Central.
Yeah, those catacombs are closed down.
Oh, yes. But what it makes, I want to leave that air of mystery, but I think for me is also, I think it should be made a point too about this as a very Pittsburgh collection. And how, you know, there's love in this poem, but I think there's also a very strong sense of what that neighborhood is. You've been to Polish Hill, and everybody should be to go to Polish Hill before it gets totally ruined by gentrification. It's starting. It's on Barrington Street and on or street, I forget. But the one, you know, the record store and the coffee shop are on those.
Yeah,
those.
Dobson.
Dobson, yeah, Street, yes, there, thank, yeah, you. Those, I only had half a beer. Dobson Street, it's happening, there's going to be columns, but the sense of that neighborhood is so strong in the way that it's kind of shrunk and encapsulated and, you know, thing. But so, I mean, thoughts about this as a Pittsburgh collection, or was that, again, a lucky accident, or was it also just the people that you selected?
There are no accidents. There are no accidents.
Yeah, I mean, I think most, if not all, of the contributors are either Pittsburghers or have strong Pittsburgh ties. Yeah. So I think it was, yeah, part of the selection process of the people we wanted in this anthology. We knew it was going to end up being a love letter to Pittsburgh overall.
Yeah, yeah. And again, working the way we work, we wanted to make sure that they were people that we knew and that we knew we could work with just personality-wise, that, you know, that the way we were going to do this would be cool with them and they'd understand what we were doing. And people that, if it was necessary, we could always speak to them just face to face about what was going on with the project. It was late coming out. I foolishly thought we could have this out. If we pushed it, we could have this out last Valentine's Day. It's like, oh, that's an easy promotion. That'll be fun to do. Yeah, that didn't happen.
Yeah, here we are.
It's like, Halloween is scary. A lot of scary.
It's like, I know these things take at least a year every time we do it, and then I think, oh, I could probably do this one faster, and it's, no, it never. We only did one faster, and that was a mistake, and we'll never do it. Not the book. The book was not a mistake. The book is great. We love the book. But the kind of pushing the schedule on it was the mistake. Yeah.
And an anthology is herding cats.
Yeah, I mean,
a little bit. As someone who's trying to do an edited collection of essays right now, it is herding cats. But actually, speaking of the contributors, actually, could somebody get on their Don Pardo voice?
You have one? You're a better mimic than I am.
Yeah.
And actually read the...
Read the contributor cast.
Yeah.
People
know what they're getting into and how they have to now frenzy to try to get one of the remaining.
Only 200 of you will be lucky enough to have one.
Yes. Okay, so this is our contributor list. We've got Jen Ashburn, Jason Baldinger, Stephanie Bria, Sheila Carter-Jones, Angel Ellis, Celeste Gainey, Richard L. Gijic, John Grahalski, Lori Jaquila, Chuck Kinder, Nancy Krigowski, Ali Melaninko, Dave Newman, Bob Paycheck, Bart Solarchuk, Megan Tudelow, Robert Walicki, or is it Walicki?
I think it's Walicki.
Robert Walicki, Barrett Warner, Don Wentworth, and Stephanie Wukopalan. I don't know if I got her name right either. But
tell them what they won.
And now I say no overdubs, but I, you know, should I put cheesy applause, like get an applause track to go as people, you know? But yeah, so it's again a fantastic collection, and I think it's also too. I mean, their love, I don't know, memories of love. I think are also tied to place, aren't they? I mean, you know.
So there's a quote by Richard Price that I use a lot in teaching and that I think about a lot in my own work, so much that it's tattooed on me. Oh. But it's, where you're from is the zip code of your heart. Mm. And so I think in some ways, we talk a lot about when I work with students that, you know, love it or hate it, where you're from influences you as a writer in some very base way. And I think that since you chose all these poets that had ties to Pittsburgh, whether they're here now or they're not, place is definitely going to figure into that in some way as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's black and gold. It's,
yeah.
We can't get away from that. I mean, it definitely, I mean, the other topic of the first anthology would have been Pittsburgh. Yeah. It was either going to be one or the other. And
Pittsburgh or love.
Pittsburgh or love.
Pittsburgh or love.
Same thing. So, is that, yeah, so that... definitely makes sense. I want to hear Stephanie read her other poem because it kills me. This poem kills me.
It absolutely
there,
does.
There
yes.
are lines in here.
Do it, do it,
so
do it.
So this is also a Polish show influenced poem.
Huh. Mm.
So weirdly enough.
Funny.
But place is not so obvious that you guys didn't pick up on that.
Yeah. So Gooski's a rock room.
Or the house bar.
Can I say, or are you gonna edit it out?
Doesn't matter. No,
it's definitely it's definitely a Gooski's poem. I'm proud to say that.
Yeah. That would have been the third selection of subject matter for the anthology.
Just Gooski's poems. Gooski's. We did talk about a bar. We did talk about a bar book, didn't we? And it was gonna be a map.
Right.
For college kids to go and drink at all these bars. Yeah,
like the World's End.
So I feel like, but with poems at each location, I think we should still work on that.
And we were thinking about doing a book as coasters at one point, weren't we?
Were we going to
put poems on coasters and just sell the book as a stack of coasters?
We have a lot of drinking influenced ideas.
Where
are you from? It's a good of your heart. That's
some
right.
ideas sound better the more you drink.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, hey, capitalism, you know, if it sells, it sells. That is the arbiter of all human interaction. Except for maybe love. Maybe love. And security. Love, security, and capitalism. Here we go. No, but... But yeah, no, this poem is also fantastic, and I'll geek out about it when you're done reading it.
Well, I think I want to talk a little bit about vulnerability first. Rich spoke a little bit about how he was very, very nervous to submit his poems and be vulnerable and put himself out into the world.
Rich
with
has
this.
Been weeping the whole
podcast. You guys,
silent
you can't
tears.
See it
silent tears.
Silent tears.
Whereas I, on the other hand, have no problem standing up in front of a room full of people and talking about my feelings. But I'm very bad at one-on-one connecting with people, which is why I would probably be bad at a love call-in show where I solve people's relationship problems because I'm real bad at my own, always. So, this is called On Being Told I Am Bad at Vulnerability. I want to tell you how I feel always, not just when I am five beers in, your face backlit by neon beer signs, and the once unbroken $20 bill that marked my place at the bar, now reduced to whiskey tin shot glasses, a couple of ones. No good ideas come after midnight. Trial and error has proven this true. I wish the sun comes up early, forces words to break out of my chest, or maybe you can slice the cavity between my ribs. I'll sigh relief as feelings spill open, fill space between us. That won't happen. Instead, a damaged, drunken Gretel, I leave a trail of clues. I speak in my own language. If you could translate, you would know that if I call you three times in a week, it means every day I think of things I want to tell you. That when I kiss your forehead, I mean square on the lips. That when we spoon in bed, breathing synchronized breath, I have fallen so deeply for you, I don't know how to come up for air.
Yeah. Those lines kill me. If I call you three times in a week, it means every day. Every time I read that poem.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That was so good. I mean, I guess it's you have me thinking about these conversations I have with students, you know, and how it's weird also. So, okay, I'm being damaged as an English professor. As I oftentimes, as I was reading this the three times, I was like, wow, you know, what would I have to explain if I assigned this book in class? You know what I mean? Like, that would be part of the thing. Like, what would I have to explain? And the sort of mature understandings of, and the thought about, you know, yeah, what you cannot say as being as important in a relationship as what can easily be said. And how hard, I think, I don't know, 18-year-old student, person, narcissist, whatever, would be able to be able to explain that. And, you know, it's that Jacques Lacan thing about the truth being the hottest of hot potatoes and perhaps so cheer up. It's that according to Lacan, we don't go into states of denial. Denial is our very state of living. And isn't that a lovely French nihilistic sort of way to move forward and feel okay about oneself?
I think that is, yeah. That feels so much better. So much I think I'm okay with that. Yeah. Really good.
So good. Well, part of the, I think, what I, one of the things I really like about the collection is that the poets, and within, you know, the submissions and throughout the book, there are a lot of stages of love, infatuation, obsession, mature sort of adult relationships, aging relationships,
grief,
absolutely, that are presented. That it was, you know, if again going back to what you were sort of asking before about asking people to give you love poems and what would you expect to get back, flowers and, you know, chocolates and all that.
Yeah.
What came back was the gamut of experience, which was, you know, really from our perspective, really wonderful to work with, because it allowed, as far as putting the book together, a lot of directions to go in, a lot of movement for the book, that it wasn't simply
like one, you know, note.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't like a Bananarama song. It was. It had it. Not nothing against Bananarama, but it had all of these. Yeah. It had a lot of depth to it and a lot of growth. There was a lot of movement from different perspectives of relationships and love. So that for me was really a rewarding thing to kind of work with and see. And what I really enjoy in reading the book is having those levels of the experience, that it's not simply, you know, one consistent line through the book.
Yeah, and different tones too. I think you, well, we, in the introduction, we talk about different kind of tones. The introduction, which was initially slated as an afterword.
Yeah, that was an argument.
Which kind of, yeah.
That's the most difficult thing.
It became an argument, and then it ended up being an introduction. But
was a bit of the
but I think we, the editors, discuss in the introduction the different kind of tones you get too. You know, where we start with Celeste Gainey, whose poem I love, but it's this a very different tone than a lot of the poems in the anthology.
Yeah, it's there's a definite sort of black comedy about Celeste's poem and its use of the nuclear tests as a kind of site for love, for an expression of love, and like Scott was saying, we said in the introduction what became clear was we had in putting the sequencing the book. There were a lot of ways to go, but there were two distinct poems that were outliers to the collection. Celeste's, which was one extreme in its treatment of love and its vision of how to approach it and talk about it.
Yeah.
And Dave Newman's at the end with the Cinnamon Challenge, which is a very different poem from the rest in the book, although we do get family poems, particularly from Chiquila.
Yeah.
Married to Newman, so it's the same family.
Yeah.
But we get that kind of familial adult perspective as well, and Celeste's kind of overblown, I don't want to say adolescent, but it's certainly at another end of the spectrum of an emotion that we would classify as love. So those two kind of fell outside of everything else and became the way of organizing the book. Like, you can move from Celeste's kind of overheated, you know, not to be a pun, but
it's overheated. It's out there.
It's there. It's been there. Recorded. You know, there's some fission in that poem. And then to Dave's more kind of sedate poem about his kind of reflection on a more, I guess I would say, not I don't know what I would say. It's definitely a different, it's a mature kind of vision of love, an earned love. Not that Celeste isn't, but it's just kind of a different tack on it. So those two kind of fill outside everything else.
Yeah.
And I think looking at the book, you can kind of see that, where would you put them in the middle of the book without interrupting something?
Yeah.
So those became kind of two poles that we could kind of fashion everything around. And you can read the book front to back or back to front with those two kind of moving you in one or the other direction. And it kind of moves in one way and then kind of fragments a little bit.
Which kind of then leads me to maybe my last question, or not maybe my last question, because there's the bottom five coming up still, but in terms of, you know, think about the four of you now as poets, and you can kind of drop your editor hats for a second. Because, again, looping back to Stephanie's poem, the way that, you know, I thinking again about how relationships, whether it's familial, whether it's intimate, whether it's romantic, whether it's professional, whatever, have that sort of third rail. Right, there is that thing that cannot be touched, that thing that cannot be mentioned at Thanksgiving dinner, that thing that cannot, you know, be, and how also though, and it's this interesting push me pull you thing about how as artists then and poets, your job is to kind of find those gaps or maybe find those limits to kind of expand the human imagination, and. Maybe I should assign this to my students. They would buy all the copies.
Though. Excellent. You should do that.
Sales.
I don't know. Would that be a conflict of interest at this point? I don't know. But how do you approach that, too, thinking about, like, sort of, you know, in terms of subject matter or what you want to explore or what you want yourself to be vulnerable enough to explore in thinking about, you know... how maybe our experiences are limited or how we articulate our unfreedom or how do you just kind of go into those dangerous areas and write and create and kind of process through, you know, how does that work for all of you and how do you negotiate that?
I guess maybe this answers your question. I kind of think about the work that I do, I always keep in the back of my mind, poetry for everyone. It's like a phrase. So I think my poems are somewhat easy to understand.
Yeah.
That anyone, like my grandma, the woman I work with, whoever it is, could pick up the poem and kind of see a little kernel that they can latch onto. The language is easy. The subject matter is something that maybe they can relate to in some way. And maybe it veers towards this idea that topics that are a little bit, not necessarily taboo, but like you said, that they're
uncomfortable. Uncomfortable
is a really good way of saying it. But at the same time, we all experience those uncomfortable situations or those comfortable situations or those happy situations or whatever they are. And so by like kind of keeping that in the background, I think that's sort of how I approach all of my work, maybe. Does that kind of make sense?
No, absolutely. And so I guess for the girl who dated your upstairs neighbor... she needs that poem.
Correct.
In a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and would and could and should be able to get it. And,
correct. And that where she obviously has most likely never heard this poem.
Yeah,
but maybe she will buy one of these two.
Or listen to the podcast. Yes. We're giving it away for free.
That's right.
Now.
We are, yes. but someone else. Someone else, hopefully, maybe would see their experience or even someone that they know and be like, hey, this is, you know, I can relate to this. Poetry is not this thing that's this other that's for someone else that's on this book on this shelf or in this college class or in this whatever. Like, it really is for me, too. And so that's kind of how I approach
that. Well, I think we're touching on something I've thought of, too, which is that with my poems, and some of these end up being love poems, I think that sometimes when I'm writing, it's writing the thing that like I couldn't say or that I didn't say. And
the
so
spirit of the stairs?
Yes, spirit of the stairs, exactly. It's the vulnerability thing, but sometimes it's just like I didn't get a chance to say this or I wasn't able to articulate this or whatever. And I think, you know, like that poem, you know, with you, like works to that.
Mm-hmm. Rich.
You're up. All right. Well, I tend to not write toward a certain subject. I think it's found for me in the editing process. And we talked about before about, you know, love poems and how the first thing you think of are roses and flowers and shit like that. But, you know, and, you know, honestly, it's, I figure out what I want to say about, you know, 4 or 5 drafts in when I'm trying to, when I'm stripping away all the stuff that I already thought of and get and drill down into the subject matter. And then I, you know, I generally find what it is I'm trying to say in those moments through the editing rather than anything else. Because most of my poems, the genesis is either like I see something or that I think is interesting, I hear someone say something that is interesting and I write about that, but then going through the edits is when I really figure out what I want to say.
Yeah, I'd follow up on that. Like when I write, for me, the worst things that I write are the ones that I've planned out or I have an idea going into. There's nothing worse for me than to kind of figure out a poem before I start writing it. I like to have some vague concept or a line or just the most generic line I like starting with. You know, swipe something out of a book, rearrange some of it, and just make it as generic as possible, and then kick the boat off the shore and just see where it goes. I prefer to be surprised by how the things end up, where they go, what they tackle, if they tackle anything. But I, for me, the process of writing the poem and why I keep coming back to it is I like to see where it goes. I don't want to know where it's going to go. So it's important to me to just have that as a constant in the process. So I don't set out to write love poems or any other kind of poem for the most part, but sometimes they just end up that way.
So in that sense, I guess drafting is this leap of faith, act of discovery then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what makes it fun. I mean, I if you know where it's going to go and what it's going to be about, why the hell do you need to do it? I've written a lot of novels in my head that I know how are going to finish, so why would I bother actually writing the stupid fucking book? Pointless. That's just a waste of time.
Yeah, that reminds me of something. I remember reading an interview with Elliot Smith, who he said that he would stop. He would stop performing a song live once he figured out what it meant.
It is part of it. I mean, just the kind of mystery of the thing keeps you coming back.
Yeah.
Like, certainly for me, that's part of the why do you write poetry? I want to see what I write.
And so do you find that for those of you who are left thinking about we lost somebody, but you didn't hear unless I said something about it. You see, that was the Scott tried so hard to open that door without making a sound, and I don't think he did.
No.
And we ruined it. I ruined it. I screwed it up. But, I mean, is it also, like, for you guys writing... See, I was going to ask this question. We had the last question, but now it's a follow-up question. In terms of, like, discovering things about yourselves, then, or discovering, you know... Is it for you, since you got me on this thought, Christopher, is it like, well, I didn't know I felt that way about this situation, or if I had this memory...
Kind of. I don't know that I present myself as a mystery to myself. I'm, you know... pretty self-aware.
But what about Lacan?
Fuck that guy. What about him? Jesus. I agree with Rich that you just kind of want to figure out where the poem's going. It's not about you. I mean, you're the kind of genesis and the engine behind the thing. At least I think most of the people we know write out of personal experience. From one level or another, how autobiographical it is, whatever. But there's generally a kernel of personal experience in what we write. I think that's true of everybody here. But after that, it's about what the poem's going to be, and that's up to rhythm and language and the kind of images that pop into your head and the things that you work with. again, it comes down to me that at the end, you need to be kind of surprised by what's there. It's like, if it didn't turn out the way I expected it, or I like you're saying, mm-hmm. I don't really know completely what it's about. I can't, you know, just put my thumb on the whole thing and say, this is it. Then that was a victory. That was, you know, why I did it.
So we're back to Roland Barthes and the death of the author.
Well, sure.
And you're already dead, as you...
You keep saying that. Every time I'm on this show, you say I'm dead. I'm going to get a complex.
Sorry.
Kind of creepy.
It is weird.
Yeah, it is weird. But on that happy note, actually, before we move to the bottom five, Richard, could you read Rocks for us? Can we
do all right.
Okay.
Trilogy here?
I feel like I'm at that rock show and, like, the... band's going to play that song you really wanted to hear.
Play Stairway!
Freebird, man. Okay, rocks. She wore rocks in her bra, gemstones and crystals polished smooth to bring love and openness, calm and peace, good fortune, and the short shot of wealth during a Saturday night shift. And when I'd unhook it, they'd slide down her freckled breasts into the sheets, where in the afternoon, if the sun was shining at the right angle through her open bedroom window, they'd reflect a kaleidoscope on her face. And I would drift up, like a child's wayward balloon, into the cloudless sky.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Just had my lighter. Mm-hmm. So how do people get this fine collection into their hot little hands? I guess
there are several ways, right?
There are several ways. What are the ways in which, before we move to the bottom five?
So locally, it is available at Galavan Bookshop, White Whale Bookstore, Nine Stories Booksellers in Lawrenceville,
City of Asylum
at Alphabet City Bookshop. Got all those words in there for Leslie. It is also available online through Amazon, but not actually through Amazon, but my own shop through Amazon.
Okay, so that's so, yeah, a little better.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're an international lover, you can get it.
All you international
lovers. We at least have one regular listener in New Jersey.
We're big in France. So yeah, there are many methods to get it, and there will be more. Awesome. There will be a launch
event. December
14th is what we're looking at as a launch.
Ooh,
wow.
But it'll probably be more of a, well, it'll be a launch and a kind of low ghost holiday party, or it'll just be people getting drunk, really.
Yeah, sounds good. And on that happy note, I think it's time for the bottom five. And since while the four of you are together and united
I
in
think
the
these
anthology,
these two should do the bottom five.
I don't even know what we're getting into. I don't know.
I'm all right.
Done it.
What's the worst that can happen?
I don't know.
I have done it. I think you can just do this.
Too. Yeah, I think. It's
all right. Well, okay. All right. All right.
Okay.
It's time for the bottom five.
They have like manuscripts, like first book manuscripts that are in process.
In the wings.
In the wings.
So
oh,
they might
yes,
be coming back.
Hopefully this isn't too scarring, and you will actually. That would be just the best.
We're robot editing, you don't ask us back.
No, I'll ask you that. No, I like your work. Again, this podcast is about me geeking out and in some small way about things that I like, and I think I've admired the work of everybody in this room before this collection came out, so...
Appreciate it.
Okay, so anyway, so please do come back. Mm-hmm. You know how to find me. You know where I live now.
True.
So when the collections come out... The Big Spiders only come out in October. And by the way, Roland Barthes' tombstone is in the front yard. I don't know if you guys
I did not notice that.
We can take a picture.
Literary death-themed tombstones in the front yard.
And buried in Regent
for Halloween? Yeah, he's buried in
I had no idea. I would have figured Paris.
With Kerouac and Ken Saro-Wiwa and Octavia Butler and Walt Whitman is actually also in the front yard for.
Funny. I just went to Walt Whitman's grave and it was Camden, New Jersey, but.
That's bottom five. New Jersey. All right. Bottom five. So you two now you have to agree.
Okay.
That's what it is. Now, since there's more than one person, you have to. So we're going to get a nice little
exercise in sort of group psychology here. I'm going to ask you five questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Here we go. Are we ready? Are we ready?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Question one. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
What kind or what particular disease?
Oh, it doesn't matter. What particular disease, I think, yeah.
Fuck!
Everybody gets this the first time they're on the podcast, so now when you do the book launch, you don't have to.
I'm going to say hepatitis C.
Well, I was...
just a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah?
I was going to say some sort of sexually transmitted disease, so
STD.
We're just going to go with STD.
That's a type. STD.
That's a good compliment. Yes, yeah. STD.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll break that down. Let's not.
All right.
Okay,
next.
Okay, that's one. Okay, question two. Question two. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night? 50-50 choice. Total elimination of day or night.
Mm.
Okay, Earth stops spinning. You're either on the sun side or the dark side.
I lived in Finland for a year as an exchange student in high school. When it was dark all the time, it was pretty horribly depressing. So I would want it to be daytime still. I would, but that's just me personally.
You know, I'm going to agree to that because I don't really get to see the sun very often. So, let's get rid of the night.
We want daytime.
Only. Ooh, that's a bulge in that. Not the way I would have gone. I would have thought. Oh, yay. It's full of surprises.
Have you
not
seen
all
insomnia?
Right. Oh.
There's like blackout. I feel like day is, yeah. Blackout
days will take
work,
care of it.
Blackout blinds work better than like those sun lamps that you sit in front of.
But
yeah,
that is true.
Yeah.
True.
And like I said, speaking from personal experience, I want day. Yeah, day.
All right. So, question three. Question three. Is there a film world, like if you could do the Gumby thing, but like instead a DVD, and you could at least visit or live in for a short time, is there a film you would like to be, if you could even just go on vacation in a movie, what movie world would you like to visit or live in?
What DVDs have Gumby jumped into?
I don't know if Gumby was around today, that's he would jump in the DVDs. I would think, because books are for losers.
Oh, yeah, true.
Film worlds that you wish you could kind of at least visit, live in, or whatever, or like just be like, oh, I wouldn't mind living that experience of that film somehow.
Mm. And we have to agree.
You have to agree. So you have to argue this out live on mic.
I mean, we're talking like, you know, motion pictures, right?
Yeah.
We're talking, you know,
motion pictures. Yeah. I think that's what we're talking.
Yeah.
Above ground, yes.
Yeah. All right.
Any ideas?
I got no ideas.
Is it Porky's?
Porky's? That's not a bad one.
I mean, I could be easily swayed because I'm like bad with remembering
Lego movie
details and.
Back to School would be a great one. I would kind of wish Rodney Dangerfield was my dad.
Yeah.
That would be pretty good.
Yeah, that's a toughie, huh?
Yeah. I mean, you get Vonnegut to come to.
That's right. Vonnegut would come
Vonnegut
to my door.
Around. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I mean, I'm going to give you that one. I think we can...
All right.
Everything I would pick would be like some weird British masterpiece theater weird thing that's not even a movie, so we really should just...
Okay, so we agree, 80s college campus.
Yes, we're going to do that. It's going to be where... Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. It was a simpler time anyway. All right, question four. Question four is the Christopher Hitchens question. Of the living villains of history, whose obituary would you most like to write?
Living villains.
The evil person has to still be with us. Huh. And you see, the way this question came from, it's in Mortality. When he found out he had terminal cancer, one of his first thoughts was like, wow, I really wish I could someday have read Cardinal Ratzinger's and Henry Kissinger's obituaries. And he goes, wait a minute, I wanted to write those. So, you know, who of the... And it, this could be, you know, just because it would be a fascinating exercise, or it would be a way of sort of skewering someone from the grave. It's your choice. But Livingville, evil person alive today, whose obituary would give you the most satisfaction of writing? That you would collaborate on, of course.
Dev?
Well, like, there's so many obvious answers. Do we take, like,
No.
I don't know if I like this question. I don't like the idea. I mean, I kind of like the idea of, like, bad people are dead, and then you get to, like, write their obituary. But I also, I don't know. I feel like that's sort of, that, like, karmic sort of wishing ill on someone.
It's not wishing ill. It's inevitable. Like, you're probably
going to outlive. I don't know. Like, because
you can say somebody you probably are going to outlive. They're going to die anyway. They're going to die anyway. There's nothing you can do. It's not like you pushed them.
Can they pass? Do you have any questions?
No. No. Maybe all four of us should agree. If this is the last one.
This is only number four. There's something worse.
I mean, who would you say?
Rattudia.
God, political. Just world figures who are evil.
Yes. There are those. Those exist.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do. And I feel like that's kind of like an easy choice, too, to be...
Yeah, I mean, we could go easy, but why go easy? I'm going to say... I'm going to say James Franklin.
I thought you were going to go with Franco.
James Franco?
Board, yeah. Yeah. Or Franco. We can go Franco.
Isn't he a poet? Isn't that part of his shtick?
Franco Harris?
No, Franco Harris. Franco Harris is a poet.
That's who I was.
Yeah,
that's
okay. I'd rather read Franco Harris than Frank...
James Franco. Franco. That's like his shtick now,
but
right?
But I'd rather read James Franco than Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
Ethan Hawke is my most evil person that I would...
You would write the obituary.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Fuck the hot estate.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Fucking Ethan Hawke. All right, I'm going to throw it out there. I think we should collaboratively write the Trump.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's like the easy answer.
I know, but it's, like, so it's glaring. It's right
easy
there.
Easy answer. It's going to happen probably in the next 10 years at least.
So people who come on are going to answer the question the same way. Like
Kim Jong Un doesn't seem like a very cool guy either. So,
no.
Like,
you know, what about him? Donald Rumsfeld?
Yeah,
that's the question.
Yeah.
Cheney has been
popular. My choice would be actually, I never answered these, but David Frum.
David Frum,
who's now the editor of The Atlantic, who suddenly has gone like sort of leftist, but he was the person who wrote the Axis of Evil speech, which is probably will be remembered as the speech that defines the American 21st century. And so I think, you know, and for someone who, you know, that he used words and language, I think that's a wonderful Faustian story. You know, there's a Faustian angle to that there.
Is Robin Leach dead?
I think so. Isn't he?
I'm going to agree with you there. I always hated that guy's accent.
Anyway, he's part of the whole sort of 80s zeitgeist of being rich is
they what only
should all aspire to fucking be.
Which is what led us to where we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a way.
Who's been answered the most? Do you have anyone that's been like a clear winner?
No, actually, it's been over the. I guess that maybe there have been two Trumps. I think there might have been two Cheneys, but other than that, it's been kind of across the map. I'd have to look it up. I don't actually listen to this podcast, so
you don't have like a cross section.
I don't have a spreadsheet.
I have a spreadsheet of who's on, and I keep these forms so that when people come back, I don't ask them these questions again. Which in itself could be interesting. You know, somebody comes back 3 years later. Are you the same person?
Has your answer changed?
Can we agree? Maybe Dave Matthews.
Can we go there?
I'll go there.
Yeah.
All right. That's a Faustian. I think there's a Faustian argument with Dave Matthews.
Well, especially with the whole shit coming down off the, like,
yeah,
which is metaphorical.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's all right. All right, we're almost out of this. And actually, the question does get kind of worse. question
I'm
five.
Beer,
you're almost done. You're almost out of here.
I'm out of beer.
All right.
I don't know.
If there is a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you expect/hope to meet. And that could be because that person's really cool and we could do the Mark Twain Letters from the Earth thing. Or it could be like, again, that person's just really evil and if I fucked up, there's no way this other person could have got into heaven. It's up to you how you want to interpret that question. There's two roads that you have to talk through first.
Who would I want to meet in hell?
Yeah.
Can't be Frick. He already has an appointment.
Yeah.
Henry Clay Frick?
Yeah, he's kind of
he once owned the land that this house is on, actually. Wow. Here we are, yeah.
But his tombstone isn't outside. It we is just got
no, rid of he's not next to Raoul Bart.
Yeah, is he, and is he why my boss bones are here?
Yeah, yes.
I'd kind of like to talk to Stalin for a little while. See what made that guy tick.
Can we just, you should just stop recording that because we can't get any better than that.
Listen to some Sinatra records with Stalin.
Yeah.
See what he thought.
Yeah.
Cue Sinatra.
Well,
I think he did come fly with me.
Yeah,
more of a Billy May guy. Oh. Nelson Riddle.
Well, I think that's about it. Again, thank you, Scott, Christopher, Stephanie, Richard, for doing this. I think it's a good idea. Hopefully you still think it's a good idea. Again, Unconditional Surrender, an anthology of love poems, is available now on Low Ghost Press. Copies are limited. Go get one. Now you will not regret it. It is moving and deep and interesting and multifaceted and beautiful and all of those things. Buy this book, buy this book, buy this book, buy this book. All right. And again, get it from Amazon, get it from any of the fine independent local bookstores here in Pittsburgh. Our next episode, well, it'll eventually happen. I mean, this is one of my trademark two-month unplanned, unannounced hiatuses. But our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, I guess. I think I still, we are. We're also, follow us on Twitter, at gonnadiepodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Later, meets.